Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello and blessings to all. Welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by Starseed Gems, proud sponsors of the 8th Annual Original Afterlife Conference, November 6th through 10th, 2014, in Durham, North Carolina. And they can be found at www.starseedgems.com. Our guest tonight is Dr. Sally Reinfeather, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. So, Bob, what's up with you?
Oh, lots of stuff, and first we'd, of course, like to acknowledge today being a day of reflection of those who have passed in mass 13 years ago, you know, today, and it's hard to believe it's 13 years, and it just shows the anniversaries to those who grieve the loss of a loved one can be such a trigger, you know, to some people, I would say to most, you know, sometimes for, I don't know, you know, what the real reason is. I mean, when you're grieving, every day could be a trigger, but certain anniversaries, birthdays, dates of death certainly take precedence over all the other stuff, and can be very, very traumatic.
I think we live in a culture where we organize all of our happy celebrations around the repeat year, the repeat date each year, so anniversaries, birthdays, stuff like that. But death anniversaries become very difficult, even the anticipation of it, because we, in our culture, we've always associated these things with something that's happy. So now how am I going to get through this? Because it's not a good day, and it wasn't a good day when it happened, and now I have to focus on it again.
Right.
And there's no getting away from it.
In other news today, I saw there was a report on the AP that, and I know you always talk about this, and it seems to be happening with more frequency, but an extreme solar flare it's blasting its way towards the Earth. And these solar storms are not unusual. You know, they do happen often. But according to this expert, he said, what makes this one more worrisome is its location on the sun along with its strength. He said there's been a giant magnetic explosion on the sun. Because it's pointed right at us, we'll at least catch some of the cloud of highly energized and magnetized plasma that can disrupt Earth's magnetic sphere, which sometimes leads to temporary power grid problems. So, you know, they would expect some disruptions in power grids and satellites and radio transmissions. But the thing that caught my eye is we know from a lot of the experts that we talk to that psi abilities sometimes correlate with geomagnetic conditions. So I just wonder if people at the same time when we see these disruptions in these grids, maybe the unseen grid of information also comes into play. Wouldn't that be something if all of a sudden people, more people, are discussing these intuitive experiences?
Well, would those random number generators also spike at the same time? Would that?
I don't know, because that seems to have to do with people focusing on one particular thing.
Yeah, but that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, but not
everybody's psychic energy all of a sudden starts getting all riled up.
Possible, yeah.
And isn't that what's happening?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's quite the same thing as outwardly focusing your attention on one particular thing.
Well, that's what they're calling it. They don't know exactly what triggers those random number generator readouts.
Right.
But if it has something, and it should have something to do with psychic energy, it should have something to do with the energy that's within us that some of us recognize and some of us don't, that some of us are able to utilize in the work that they do each day, and some of us don't know how to access it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we'll see. Be interesting. I'll be keeping my my physical senses open to hearing about some of those things.
I'll keep my psychic senses open.
There was another story about a... it says there's a gentleman named Ben McMahon, and his parents were overjoyed when their son woke up after a week in a coma, and they were shocked to learn that he could no longer speak English. And in fact, as he came out of the coma, they said his eyes set upon an Asian-looking nurse, and the first thing that came was natural, and he started speaking Chinese language to the nurse. So, of course, the scientists... have a name for it. It's called foreign language syndrome.
Of course.
It says, one of the scientists said, well, foreign language syndrome occurs after a serious accident or injury to the brain renders victims unconscious. When the patients come around, they find themselves talking in completely different languages that they weren't able to speak prior to the incident.
But they had no education in.
Yeah, although at the end of the story, it does say that this, Ben did, as a child, study Chinese. He was not fluent in it at all, and now, of course, he was speaking, fluently. So that, that brings other things into question. But there are other cases like this, and the one quote from a psychiatric expert is, in earlier times, this would have been referred to as a miracle. But we prefer to think that there must be a logical explanation. We just haven't found it yet. So how many times have we heard that? They don't consider any non-materialist theory. It has to be, a logical, physical, biological, neurochemical explanation for it. And
in absence of that, that's why they call all of these things syndromes, because they can't find any explanation for restless leg syndrome and all these other crazy syndromes that come up. I'm not suggesting that there's any psychic abnormality with restless leg syndrome. I'm just saying that that's just par for the course as to how the medical field operates. As long as they can give it a title, then the pharmaceutical companies can go ahead and make a medicine that goes with it.
Right. And, of course, everything that we discuss, scientists are searching, they dismiss any otherworldly kind of occurrences, and they just keep searching for the scientific explanation. Of course, they've been trying to do that with consciousness for hundreds of years and haven't been able to come up with any plausible theory. When they talk about near-death experiences, it has to be some process in the brain. Same with deathbed visions. So many things are immediately dismissed. So one day we'll make some headway in changing worldview about that.
I think we're doing that already.
So you clipped out something. There was a quote from Lauren Bacall before she passed.
Yes, it's interesting because I think this went to print before she passed. She passed, and then the magazine came out. But her birthday was on September 16th, and she became 90, and they quoted her as saying, "I think you have to be unconscious to be happy."
Right.
Brilliant. It's really brilliant, because how many people are walking around on the face of the seeking happiness? Nobody's happy. From people who have gazillion billion dollars and have every toy in the world to you know, just your average.
Well, we can interpret that quote also to be being unconscious, being in an altered state. You know,
right,
you know,
right.
Yeah.
Which very well may be what she has meant
right.
by that.
She's in an altered state now, for sure.
Yeah, well, maybe she'll contact us tonight.
Right.
We'll be set.
All right, we're going to go to our break. Come back. We're going to have a wonderful guest, Dr. Sally Reinfeather. So stay with us, and we'll be talking about a lot of unseen things. We'll be back in a few.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
It's a perfect combination. Great mediums, great food. On September 14th, enjoy a delicious Italian meal at the famed Pomodorino restaurant in Huntington, New York, and be treated to 2 hours of spirit communication by Forever Family Foundation certified mediums Lynn LeClaire and Rebecca Ann LeCicero. Proceeds go to support the programs of Forever Family Foundation, a 100% volunteer 501c3. For reservations, visit the event page at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call 631-425-7707.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken, even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Sally Reinfeather. Our sponsor is Starseed Gems, proud sponsors of the 8th Annual Original Afterlife Conference, November 6th through 10th, 2014, in Durham, North Carolina this year. And they can be found at starseedgems.com. Bob?
And we're honored to have tonight's guest, Dr. Sally Reinfeather. She's a widely recognized expert in the field of parapsychology. She's the daughter of J.B. and Louisa Rein, founders of what is now the Rein Research Center. She grew up in the world of parapsychology in Durham, North Carolina. She earned her doctorate in psychology from Duke University. She worked over 30 years as a clinical psychologist in mental health and psychiatric clinics. And since 1995, she's been active in the Rein Research Center in various administrative roles, serving on two different occasions as volunteer executive director. She wrote a wonderful book that she co-authored with Michael Schmicker called The Gift, which is an update of Louisa Rhine's work on spontaneous ESP experiences. And you can learn a lot more about Rhine on the website rhine.org. Welcome to the show, Sally.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And, you know, of course, I mentioned Rhine, and, you know, sometimes we take for granted that, I mean, those of us that are in this genre of study, of course, are well-versed in Rhine, but not everybody else is. So how about a little brief history of the Rhine Research Center, how it came about, and maybe some current, you know, focus and interests?
Oh, okay. Great. Well, it began when my parents, both of them, and I'll speak of them together because they were always a team, kind of like you two, I believe, and even though my mother was in the background raising children. But they were trained as scientists at the University of Chicago in plant physiology, and somewhere along the way heard some psychic stories from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and other people like that and started reading and realized, you know, they had lost their religion when they went to college, but they always had those big questions. What is the nature of man? Is there something more? Is there a soul? Is there something that survives bodily death? Those seemed to me, to them and to me, more important than anything they could have gotten in their conventional scientific approach. So they switched fields, which was kind of difficult to do back in the late 1920s. Went off to Boston, investigated a medium that they expected was going to really, you know, help them learn a lot more, and instead they discovered fraud. That's not uncommon, particularly back in those days. And they were disillusioned, but not to give up. They looked and studied a little more, and finally, to make a long story short, they ended up in Durham, North Carolina, of all places, in the late 1920s. This was a dirty, dusty little old town. But there was a professor here, William McDougall, at the university, starting at Duke University, the first psychology department. He was open to the concept of studying psychical research, which would be the study of afterlife and psychic phenomena. He was open to that. They came down here hoping to get some scientific tests of postmortem survival, as it was called. That was really the reason for coming. Well, it didn't work out quite that way because they couldn't even, although they had some wonderful mediumistic material from collected by someone and sent them down here. It wasn't enough to get a, you know, to get a conclusive answer. So they took a side step to say, what are the psychic abilities of living people? Because if there is postmortem survival, spirits are going to have to communicate by psychic, by telepathy, or it was along the same path. It was the ground floor, what I would call it, the ground floor. They had to establish that. And then that led them into the study of what's called ESP, extrasensory perception, with living people. And they began, got a job at Duke, instructor in psychology, working with college students. McDougall and Ron directed that. And they began to test ordinary people for, was there such a thing as telepathy that they could put into a scientific framework? And that was the beginning of there was a Duke Parapsychology Laboratory. There were ESP was extrasensory perception, was the word they used for what they were doing. And it became a household word after they published their first two or three years of results. So that was the actual beginning. And then it went on further.
Yeah, well, I thank you for that, because I never realized that the initial impetus, you know, for their work was really seeking survival evidence. You know,
and they actually kept on studying mediums for the first 10 years, including the famous Eileen Garrett.
Yeah.
You know, hoping that they would find some quick and easy solution to it, but as we all know, this is not an easy topic to pin down.
Right.
We may feel it's there. We may believe there's something a lot there. But to put it in, to capture it in a way that's convincing to somebody who hasn't had experiences, that's the job of science.
Yeah. You know, so thinking back, you know, your father, J.B. Ryan, I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, a true pioneer in the field of parapsychology and brought the subject of ESP into mainstream awareness for the first time. And I look around today and I see so many researchers and scientists that have faced and still face uphill battles in terms of attacks on their reputation and criticism from colleagues and the sparsity of funding. I can only imagine that the challenges faced by JB were even worse today, being the first one.
Oh, absolutely, totally. I'm having to read the letters. We're going back and looking at the early letters. It's amazing. One letter will be somebody who's gotten some remarkable results or experiences and is all excited and thinks this is the most important thing in the world. The next letter is practically saying he's a fraud. How could you be studying such an outrageous thing? We know in advance it's not true.
I know.
You heard them both, probably.
Yeah. They say these are, I wouldn't believe it even if it was true, right?
Yeah. That might have come from Einstein. That came from some pretty important people. You know?
Yeah. No. So do you think, have we made progress, you know, since JB's time in gaining acceptance in the scientific community?
Yes and no. The fact, maybe more in Europe and England, it's pretty well established in the universities, which doesn't mean there aren't skeptics, but it's entrenched in their courses and the university degrees and so forth. In this country, less so, and it's been a struggle in the last 10, 20, 30 years. And it's primarily financial, I think. And then there's also, Bob, there's organized resistance now that didn't used to, the skeptics were there, but they weren't all in mass and, you know, to stomp out anything that might be said at all in favor of this. You know, let's say Wikipedia is just a good example of that. That's an organized, that there'll be nothing reported there that we would call factual.
Yeah. That's certainly true. You know, what I always wanted to ask you, so you're growing up with two parents that are certainly gaining a lot of notoriety and attention. Was there any pressure ever put on you by either of your parents to continue in the family business of parapsychology?
Not really. I think they both wanted me to follow my own pathway. I will say that my father was probably, mid-year in college, I was thinking I would maybe come back to Duke from the college I was in Ohio. And my mother said, well, think it through really carefully, dear, before you mention it to your father.
Because,
you know,
yeah.
It would have just been so, I had worked in the field before I went to college in the summertime and ultimately ended up there, but not completely. But basically, they had good sense, and I think my decision was my own to go my own way. And ultimately, sad to say, after they passed away, here I am back again. So let's just suppose that somewhere, if their spirit is watching me, that they're happy that I finally came back into the field.
Well, I think they surely are. I know that one of your great research interests is ESP in children. Do children make better research subjects because of their innocence and the fact that they haven't been, you know, indoctrinated into all these so-called cultural and societal conditions?
I would say from the report, not so much of the experimental, because it's difficult. You have a lot of patience to work with children, as you do with animals or anybody that just doesn't sit down and do just what you, as a researcher, ask them to do. There've been some really good children subjects, and I report one in my book of where I saw a little girl just get a phenomenal amount of success in the ESP card test. But I also, from reports, just from the experiences, that's another strong interest of mine, following my mother's interest and the cases and things in a sense to me. Now, we don't take those as proof per se, but you read 100 of them, and you know, in a sense, it backs up what you already suspected. But it's mostly with people even your age and my age are still remembering their first experience when they were 5 or 6 years old. And it seems to me that that's when the cradle of, Larry Dossey said, infancy is the cradle of telepathy. I think it's strongest then until we learn not to show it or not to feel it or not to be aware of what forces there may be about around us.
Yeah, and I remember reading that, I think the case that you referred to, where you visited a classroom in Minnesota.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, tell us a little bit more about that, because as I recall, I mean, that was pretty astounding what the child did.
Here I was in my early 20s, and I went off. They sent me off to Menominee, Wisconsin, because there was a woman there, a teacher, who was very, very interested in this topic. And she, in a one-room schoolhouse, one of the last remaining ones back in the 50s, and her children, particularly some that were interested in that loved her, would she was doing these little tests. Now, she was looking at the ESP card and, like, sending it, the symbol, to this little girl. And this was a typical noon hour test while the rest of the kids were outside playing. And she stood at the blackboard, and she pointed up to first the star and then the cross and then circled the targets that the teacher was looking at. And she missed the first one, and she got 4 out of 25 right. The chances of that are incredible. I was there. I know the teacher wasn't whispering, but I couldn't prove that later, you know, enough to publish it. But I saw the most phenomenal. But what impressed me so much was the little girl just loved this teacher, and she was almost in a trance. You know, she was in an altered state when she got into this. And I think that we look at these things for clues now. We can't look at them for proof. But there was something going on between the teacher and the child, and the child's devotion. I've seen those and heard those reports quite a few times, mostly from children, sometimes adults. But they get into an altered state, and it's like another world.
Yeah, you do raise an interesting point, though. Even in adults, I mean, do you think that there's a sometimes there's a bond that forms between the research subject and the experimenter, and you know, maybe that has an effect on the results. I mean, they talk about experimenter, you know, bias, mm-hmm. but I guess that could work both ways, right?
No, I think it's a strong the person who is the so-called subject or participant has to be comfortable, relaxed, and if there's rapport and if there's motivation. This is why my dad got some really good results when he was starting out. And it wasn't that he was naive about methodology. They were pretty careful then. But some of his early subjects, he got phenomenal results. But that was my dad. He was like, he could sell, you know, he could sell anything. He was a natural salesman, and he believed in this. And he got people just sensed that about him. And when there was a rapport, he was another one of those people. He was a good hypnotist. He used to hypnotize college students. And I think that type of experimental. There are other excellent experimenters, but I think there's something special about them, and the bonding. And we also know that from if you do tests in the school system, the children that like their teachers and teachers like their children score a lot better with each other than just the average ordinary pairing of people. Mm. So we know that, but it's hard to control that all the time, and it's complicated.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking, I understand why people, many people are fearful of the unknown. So, you know, they're fearful of seeing an apparition. But I never quite got why people are fearful of telepathy. I mean, yeah.
It seems like the safest thing, doesn't it, in the
yeah.
world? You know, of course, if you exaggerate it, it's a few people who get kind of misled, or maybe they're just not in touch with reality, overdo it, and they think that somehow, because some telepathy works, that means somebody's reading their mind all the time. Well, it's not that way. It's a very, it's a weak ability. You know, it's not that strong. But sometimes you may know what's going on at home. Something's wrong at home, and you know, you sense that. Well, women sense that, particularly if a child. They have little children at home, and they just know something's wrong. That's the level of telepathy, knowing it's usually somebody you love, somebody is close to you, either telepathy or just remote viewing, knowing there's danger ahead, either present or coming in the future. It's not dramatic. It's not going to happen every day, but it's enough so that if it's happened to you several times, you take it seriously. And we who read these reports, hundreds and thousands of them, we take it seriously, too.
Yeah. And thank goodness that you do. But the so when you talked about these precognitive experiences, I mean, the most overall, the most of these experiences happen in dreams, you know, where people have visions of a future event.
Yes, they dreams seem to be about 60% of the cases that my mother, she collected over 12,000 or more cases over the 20 years that she studied it specifically, and we are continuing to find that same sort of percentage that it seems to occur more frequently in the dream state. I think that has to do with the mind being relaxed, and you're cutting out stimulation from the outside world. Maybe you're more in tune, like I said, the little girl was in a dreamlike state. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know. In the book, The Gift, you have a bunch of stories about these precognitive experiences. One was particularly compelling, where there was a woman had a vision of a fire at the Pentagon. You recall that?
Yes, and that's appropriate because today is the 9/11, of course, and this is a woman whom I'm still speaking to. I know her very well. It was a couple weeks before the events of the Pentagon actually being on fire, and she was up in Washington coming home with her husband driving nearby the Pentagon area, and she looked over and she screamed. Her husband said, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" And she says, "The Pentagon's on fire." And he said, no, nothing's wrong. Look again." Well, she looked again, and she didn't see the fire. But for a moment, she had seen something which then turned out to be what happened 2 weeks later when, in fact, the plane hit the Pentagon and was on fire. And then that's that was an awaking premonition of a real event, we think, yes.
Yeah. Some people term that as a visual hallucination, right?
Yes, you could use the same term, yes.
Yeah. What was her reaction when it happened? I mean,
She came to see me because I think that it was soon after that she came to see me. She'd been seeing a counselor and had no told anybody about her frequent experiences of this sort, but this was the most dramatic. And she came and we talked about it, and we helped her realize it's not common to have such a striking experience. Not everybody does, but it's not uncommon and it's not abnormal. This is a normal ability that some people who know that usually have several, continue to have experiences. There are several by the same lady in my book, and she still today has experiences like this.
Yeah.
Now, it's a normal experience, and why some people have more than others, I don't know, but it is frightening, and we try our best to have people realize this is normal. It's not something to be scared of, and actually there's very little, nothing she could do about it except try to learn to live with it and understand it as being normal.
Yeah. This must have come in handy, your knowledge in your clinical work, because I'm sure some people came in, with these fears about experiences they were having, and who better to talk to than you?
One reason I wrote the book, The Gift, was for the people who live with people who are psychic, so you understand them better, but also for the counselors and the ministers and the pastors and the everyday people that don't understand this. People are often stigmatized. And I'm not talking about people who go overboard. You have to be cautious not to get too involved and spend too much of your time thinking about this. But if you tie it in with a normal life and balance it out and learn more about it, and in the same work that you do, you can go to extremes, or you can be too skeptical. So there's somewhere in the middle, there's a happy center of taking things fairly seriously and realizing there's something important, and keeping good records too. That's the other thing. Write them down right after it happens.
Yeah, well, that's certainly good advice. We are talking with Dr. Sally Rheinfeather. The book we mentioned is The Gift. And the website for the Rhein Research Center is rhein.org. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, there's lots more to talk about with Dr. Rheinfeather, so stay with us. I'll be back in a few.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida, fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed gems developed by the parents of a young man who passed away are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is atransc.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
Many people, just like you, hope that we continue to another existence after we die. It's a nice thought, but could it really be true? The answer is yes. There is an overwhelming amount of scientific evidence that tells us this is so. On July 29th, come hear medical doctor and university professor Dr. Piero Calvi-Parasetti as he shares a visual presentation of the life after death evidence at Long Island University in Brookville, New York. Dr. Parasetti, also a noted psychotherapist and bereavement specialist, and former humanitarian advisor to the United Nations, can show you how to turn simple hope into deep knowing. He will be joined in the second part of the evening by certified medium Laura Lynn Jackson, who will demonstrate spirit communication as further evidence of an afterlife. Advanced reservations are only $15 for members and $20 for non-members. For reservations and information, visit foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call 631-425-7707.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
You are just tuning in. Our guest tonight is Dr. Sally Rhinefeather. Our sponsor is Starseed Gems, proud sponsors of the 8th Annual Original Afterlife Conference, November 6th through 10th, 2014, in Durham, North Carolina. And Starseed Gems can be found at starseedgems.com on the internet. If you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Did you know that you can financially support the work of Forever Family Foundation, a 100% volunteer, not-for-profit organization, without sending us a single pretty penny? When shopping on the internet, think of us before you go to Amazon.com and instead go to ForeverFamilyFoundation.org and use the Amazon link to get to Amazon. Don't worry, there's one on every page of our website. And if you add that one simple step to your shopping, a dollar percentage of everything that goes into your shopping cart will generate a donation from Amazon to us. And what if you don't shop on Amazon, you ask? Not a problem. There's another way to be certain that almost all your website shopping produces a donation to Forever Family Foundation without you having to send us anything. Visit iGive.com. It's free. Sign up. Name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. And just like with Amazon, a portion of your spending results in a donation to Forever Family Foundation. Once you set it up, each time you shop on the internet, iGive.com will automatically send us a donation when you shop in one of their more than 1,400 online stores that you're probably already shopping in, like Big Dogs and Hanes. How about Home Depot or Old Navy, Sirius Radio, and Urban Outfitters? So please take a moment when you shop to show us that you care. Don't miss our Long Island fundraiser coming up this Sunday. It's called Spirit Sunday on September 14th at Pomodorino Restaurant in Huntington, New York. It features 2 hours of spirit communication following a full Italian meal complete with coffee and cannoli. And plan to get yourself to Durham, North Carolina for the biggest and best afterlife conference ever. It's a convention of the top organizations that have been dedicated to the investigation of life beyond this physical life. From November 6th through 10th, we have loads of special things planned, including a day at the Rhine Research Center with a spoon bending party. So visit our website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, and make your reservations now. This will be a big one, and you don't want to miss on all the pomp and circumstance. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Dr. Sally Rhinefeather, and we were talking about telepathy and also, you know, survival. And a lot of people don't really see the connection. They think of mediums. And they don't think of mediums and telepathy as part of the process. But in essence, don't you suppose that that's what's going on with mediums? It's telepathy, just that one party doesn't have a body?
Yeah, I think that there has to be that sort of same sort of ability going on. We just don't see the both sides of it. I definitely think so. And many psychics, certainly one of my friends who works around here that I know quite well, she will often give readings of living people of things. Now, of course, if you're talking about the future, she could be talking about precognition, just intentionally giving a prediction of what this person might need to know. Or she might say something that the person is thinking. She might pick up on their own thoughts. So we know that psychics, good psychics, have psychic ability. How they relate to the spirit world, of course, that's the mystery, is it? But whatever it is, I think it involves the communication ability that we call psychic ability.
And we're honored that you're going to be talking about, you know, psi experiences that are suggested of an afterlife, you know, at our conference in Durham. Yeah. So when we talk about psi experiences suggested of an afterlife, are we talking about what some people would call signs, you know, after-death communications?
Yes, yes. I'm not an expert in this field. I just know that I have lots of these wonderful stories, and as my mother did before me, back in her very first book, Hidden Channels of the Mind, she has a section on psychic ability from the dead, the dying, and let's get the third category, but before death, knowing about one's own death or someone else's death, then signs that might happen that seems to be coming from, like, you know, like grandma standing by your bed. Grandma died 10 years ago, but you wake up and you see her standing there and she's telling you something important. It seems like message from the other side, and we would include those in, I would include that for sure. Apparitions, but bringing information. Usually a psychic experience is something we want it to, they're providing some sort of information. Sometimes it's just the appearance. One of my favorite ones in my book, I might shorten it up and tell it now. I probably would tell it later, but I knew the man who sent it to me. We'd corresponded a lot. He was a retired scientist. And he saw the apparition of his grandmother in a situation where there were two little dogs present, and the dogs got very upset. In fact, that's what alerted him that it wasn't his hallucination, that the dogs were seeing something that he was also seeing. And that conveyed to him, and then he went at that moment, after seeing that, he went in the house down the hall where grandmother was and found out that she had just passed away. So her coming, her appearing to him at that time, brought him the information that she was passing over.
Mm. I know, yeah, I know there's a rich history, you know, of accounts like this, and even going back centuries with, you know,
yes,
Christ apparitions, and it's fascinating. Do you also collect cases of people who report, you know, premonitions of their own death?
Yes, we do have some of those. We have whatever people have sent us. I should back up a little and say how this study began and then tell you a little bit what we're going to do.
Okay.
Back in 1948, my parents had both been working. My mother had been home with children. Finally gets to the lab, getting to work at last, you know. And my dad's been working in experimental work for a decade or two and accumulating lots of factual stuff about ESP and how it occurred in ordinary life. And then she comes to work, and he says, well, there's a whole bunch of letters stacked up here. Nobody's answering them. Nobody has time to answer them. Will you take an answer? And I'm going to take a sip of water right now. Excuse me. And there were already 200 or 300 cases sent in to the lab,
huh,
which were basic dreams that come true, things we've been talking about. And there they were waiting for somebody to answer them. So she took that on as her job, and she thought, well, I'm just doing something to help out, you know, and maybe I'll pay some attention and try to sort them together and and organize them a little. And before long, she was thorough, and they were doing that kind of nonchalantly. Maybe they thought, well, they'll get some ideas for experiments. The more she got into this, and the more these letters kept pouring in from Reader's Digest stories, and when this was the only place in the country then, Bob, where you could, if you had an experience like this, where you could write to somebody and expect to get a sympathetic answer. And so it was very, very popular, and soon she was getting hundreds of letters each week.
I could imagine.
She made it into a study. I mean, she wrote about 18 different articles. She published 3 or 4 books. And she left a legacy, quite a legacy of that sort. And along with it were the stories that we've been talking about today. People's experiences of their own passing away. Usually it was more often their family, people they loved. Quite a heavy death and serious accidents were the major top. I would say a lot more prevalent than happy stories. These were warnings. It came as warnings and awarenesses of something wrong, something you should pay attention to.
Yeah.
Which makes sense if it's a biological, natural phenomena, ability that we all have. That's what our eyes and ears are for, to let us know what's happening. So,
I was going to ask you about that.
And,
you know, why, and then you just answered that, you know, why so many negative things come up in these precognitive experiences versus happy things, you know?
Yeah. We're surprised. Well, I mean, there's occasional one about a girl knowing who the man she's going to marry, or a few about the lotteries, but mostly they're warnings, as if they are something important that you need. Warnings about yourself or your family, and that's what I think. I mean, you're titled the Family Foundation, and I feel very strongly that psychic ability is an ability that we have. Maybe it began before early evolution, where groups of people maybe weren't even fully individualized. You know, you were more like a flock of birds doing things together and biologically. And then you had a warning about what was going to happen, where the food was for the clan or what the danger was, and certainly your own family, your own tribe. That's what the stories are mainly about.
Mm. So I wonder, you know, if we as a people
are now becoming more or less intuitive. You know, that we live in this age of instant information. There's no need for this, you know, flocking or gaining information intuitively. So I wonder if the, if our intuitive abilities are going to further wane or atrophy.
I wonder about that, too. My mother had so many stories with World War II era of, you know, mother knowing something was wrong with her son in the battlefield, and she wouldn't hear for 2 or 3 weeks about it. But now, you know, with email and whatever, Instagram, you would know much quicker. So you're, I think you're right that that sort of thing is probably waning because of that.
So, and this is purely a speculative answer that you would give to this, but so when people have a precognitive dream and they see an event and that event plays out, you know, so does that lead one to believe that that everything is fated, that it's inevitable, or do you think that we can change the future?
I think we can change the future somewhat. There's a chapter in my book entitled, Is Fate Inevitable? And that's actually based on some sort of research that she did, my mother did. She did such marvelous work. I wish I had, well, I like time to keep it going, to follow up what she did. But she actually took, let's say, about 500 cases in which if you could change the future, you would. Now, some of them were happy things. Well, she didn't think, she eliminated the happy things and just looked for the negative consequences. And she narrowed it down. In some cases, there were things like awareness of a tornado coming or something. And so, with it, you know, there's very little you could do about that. But she narrowed it down, and she was looking for good criteria, too. It had to come from all of her cases that she kept had to come from people that seemed like they were sane and normal. She wasn't taking them as evidence. She was looking for indications. But she narrowed it down to 8 or 9 cases where it looked like the real thing. And I, you know, you would read it and say, wow. And those are in my book because I thought that was such an important chapter, that if one does get enough information in a dream or in a waking intuition, sometimes you don't get enough. You know there's a child in danger, but you don't know which child. And there's some sad cases which in the book which that didn't work out, or yeah, which there was nothing they could do, or maybe they just forgot about it, you know. They just had a dream. Well, you don't take all of it. We can't take all of our dreams seriously. But if you do, I think, and people who have this ability and learn how to pay attention to it, you know, it's a fine line between not to go overboard and take everything as if it's a dream, a premonition. So, but yeah, that's a good question, and we're looking for more stories like this. I was going to say that we're getting ready to start a new study, and we will be posting on our website notices of how we'd like people, if they would want to tell us their experiences, they could participate in this research that we're going to be starting.
All right, so if people want to get involved, they should keep checking the website, rhine.org. And also, you can learn a lot more about the Rhine Research Center and current research projects. I know you're involved in energy work and searching, always searching and discovering. So visit rhine.org and learn all about it. And you can become a member of Rhine as well and just visit the membership page. There's a wonderful journal that's put out. And this is no fly-by-night operation. This is a scientific organization that's been doing impeccable work for decades. So if you're interested in the science at all or even in the experiences that people have, that's an excellent place to start. Sally, it's been a pleasure. I wish we had more time to talk. We could go on for hours about this stuff, but you're just going to have to come back again if you would.
Well, I've enjoyed very much being with you and Bob and Fran. And I look forward to seeing you in November at the wonderful conference you're going to have here in town.
I look forward to seeing your smiling face again as well. And again, the book is called The Gift, and you can find an Amazon link on our website. And that's also a wonderful collection of stories. So, Sally, thanks again, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
And now, before we ask our listeners, I just want to remind everybody, if you enjoyed this interview with Sally, you can meet her at the November conference in Durham, North Carolina, and get her book there and get it signed. So now let's go on and ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind as we visualize the healing light upon James Rafferty, Arthur and Bernice Goforth, Andrea Richard, David Mello, Henry Stark, Johnny Jackson, Andy O'Brien, Tanya Cash, Stanley Mullen, Glenna Irwin, Lynn Austin, Michael Tim, Patty Potter, Eileen LaFada, Wendy Lippo, Barbara Russell, Tom Donahue, Tim Donahue, Philip McPhee, Doug Barry, Brian, Andrea Nina, Diane Karen, Eddie Roll, Tracy Lee Nash, Jean Lash, Vicki Steffi, Mark Barron, Rita Springer, David Haith, Barbara Petillo, Julie Beischel, Miriam Pierzga, Jeanette Davies, Rachel Scandarian, Kimberly Saavedra, and Ann Hutchinson. And now let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this. To love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say...
Our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.